On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
Joining us shortly is educator and author John Marsden. He's written a new book. I think it's about his 714th, and this one's about the art of growing up. It's not so much about growing up, though, as really it's a guide to parenting, and it's full of advice to parents, and in particular, it bursts the balloon on some of the fads and fashions and some of the current trends. Indeed, John Marsden unloads big time on a lot of parents, people who he deals with in his daily life and people that his friends and colleagues in education deal with. In particular, some of the more unpleasant aspects of dealing with parents who either think their children are perfect or gifted or incapable of doing wrong or pretty much can't see what's going on in their own personal lives and how it's being projected onto their children's lives. John Marsden, our first guest, then Andy Griffiths, who's reworked his Treehouse book. It's apparently now the 117-story Treehouse, Andy Griffiths and Terry Denton's illustrations. It now goes to 117 stories, and as it gets bigger and bigger and the Treehouse gets higher and higher, the books are getting fatter and fatter too. So that'll be good fun too. My co-host holding my hand for the journey today is the editor of the Australian Foreign Affairs Journal. The Australian Foreign Affairs Journal's a regular thought provoker on its particular sphere, and sphere of influence is what it's about this time. Jonathan Perlman edits Australian Foreign Affairs, and Rivalry in the Pacific is the theme of their latest, which has just come out. Morning to you, Jonathan.
Good morning, John.
From Jonathan to Jonathan. Ha, that doesn't happen often. Why are you worried about the Pacific? What's going on that makes you alarmed?
Well, the government's clearly very alarmed. It's been an interesting couple of years in Australian diplomacy, really, from hearing nothing much about the Pacific for decades. Suddenly there's just been this intense flurry on behalf of the government, spending a lot of money in the Pacific, making constant visits. I mean, Scott Morrison, even just before the election, went off to Fiji and Vanuatu. There are Pacific leaders coming in all the time. The Papua New Guinea Prime Minister, I think, just arrived today for the week, setting up a $2 billion fund. There's all these sorts of activities, which is really quite unprecedented,
it's all about China.
Well, it's all about China. But that's really the one thing that that the government won't say about it, and perhaps wisely won't admit to the fact that it's all about China.
And we'll just talk.
Well,
everyone knows. Why not just be upfront about it?
Yeah, I usually think candor is better, but I think in this instance, it makes sense to talk as they do about just trying to that Australia is trying to keep rivals out without naming China. It would just be an unnecessary inflammation, but clearly it is all about China.
Inflammation of what?
Oh, tensions with Beijing. I mean, relations.
But how does it inflame China to say what everybody knows anyway? All you're doing is putting a word in. If you talk about rivalries and so on, everyone gets it. Why not? I don't understand why it inflames things to state it.
Yeah, I think on the level of rhetoric between Beijing and Canberra, it doesn't help to point a finger at China when you're starting to kind of build up these ties.
So you do every single thing that shows your concern, except say what everybody knows.
Well, I don't think it's that important, really. They're going to do this nonetheless, and it's because of China. I guess the question is really just whether Scott Morrison should be coming out and saying this is all about China. And while I think the government often does go quiet on its stance on China and could speak a lot more openly, I'm just saying in this instance, I think it just makes sense to go ahead and saying they're trying to build up their Pacific ties. They're trying to keep out foreign rivals, and there's just no need to kind of point the finger at China.
Don't think anyone loses a lot of sleep in Beijing about whether or not Australia does or doesn't say China's causing some headaches in the Pacific. I don't think they really care whether we think that or don't. They've got so much on their plate when it comes to trade wars with with America and Trump and Russia and Japan and North Korea. And I mean, we're a long way down the list of things to worry about.
China's interested in many parts of the world at the moment.
Yeah.
It's showing a lot more interest in this part of the world.
Oh, they're more worried about Belt and Road, which is heading off to Europe. They're more worried about just about everything except us.
Xi Jinping visited APEC for longer than any of that, visited PNG for APEC, for the APEC meeting, and for longer than any of the other world leaders. He is showing attention to this region. Recently, the defence minister in China hosted some Pacific leaders. It's not as important to them as other parts of the world, but they are showing direct interest. And yes, they're definitely listening to what Australia is saying about its own policy. China's quite astute, I think, when it comes to pursuing its own interests, even in this part of the world.
Can we send a cheerio to the people in the embassy who are putting highlighter pen through the translation of our conversation and monitoring every single thing that anyone says about China to try and just work out what is or isn't an issue? I think we should send a big cheerio to them because it's thankless work and, you know, they put in long hours and I just think you should all give yourselves a pat on the back and have a break, put the headphones down, go outside, enjoy the Canberra weather and have a bit of a walk around.
Yeah, it's a pity Canberra weather's not a little bit better, but yeah.
Because they do. They keep track of absolutely everything, don't they?
They do. But, you know, recently this Chinese warship descended south just out of Australia's territorial waters to spy on these war games that Australia's having with the US.
No surprise there.
No surprise. And
we do the same to them.
Exactly. So
what surprised me was that people pretended to be surprised.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, the military people weren't surprised at all. And, you know, the Australian military response was sort of seemed quite relaxed.
Don't know what they thought they'd learn.
Yeah, I don't know.
Except there were some startled tourists on the beach who didn't know there were war games on. That was funny.
Yeah, and also, you know, the Australians and Americans will probably learn a little bit from whatever's on the Chinese ship. So it goes both ways, I think.
Mm. Well, I'm sure there's, there are swimmers, people winning swimming championships who are creating a crisis in our relationship, according to some of the headlines this morning, because Mac Horton wouldn't go on the podium with Sun Yang at the World Swimming Championships. But I don't think that's going to create a major diplomatic crisis either.
No.
People get a bit ahead of themselves, don't they?
I think so, but
you're going to be able to live with Boris
Johnson. It's a delicate relationship.
It is. Are you going to live with Boris Johnson? Are we going to be able to cope?
Well, it's going to be an interesting roller coaster, I think, with Boris Johnson, and it may be a short-lived roller coaster.
Why do you think that?
Because he may not be able to deliver what he's promised. He also will want to go to an election as soon as possible. It's going to be very hard for him to unite the Conservative Party. People, you know, Philip Hammond and others are already saying they won't support him. He's overpromised on what he can do. So he's going to have to disappoint large sections of his party. It's going to be hard for him to unite the party, hard for him to deliver any sort of meaningful negotiated Brexit. If it goes to a no deal, it could be disastrous. So it's a very difficult road ahead. And everyone who's worked with Boris Johnson says that, people talk about him as being one of the worst foreign secretaries in British history.
Except the public love him. So when his standing in the polls lifts and the Tories who are looking at losing their seat suddenly put all their principled and historic objections to him aside because he might actually save their backsides, watch it turn around very, very quickly. And there will be compromise left, right and centre. There will be pragmatism left, right and centre. And people will fall in line when they realise it's either that or a high jump.
Yeah, look, that could well happen. I mean, there are other complicating factors. There's this new Brexit party, which is polling very well. And so, you know, the right wing of the Conservative Party could leak to that, and voters could leak to that. It's going to, the turbulence, the Brexit turbulence, is going to continue.
Watch this space, which is why when you have the chance, if you're in a good bookshop or even a bad one, you can pick up Australian Foreign Affairs. The current edition just published Our Sphere of Influence, Rivalry in the Pacific. And I see there's a lovely piece. Well, I think it is. I've just skimmed a few pages of it. Sean Dorney, our former PNG, our former Port Moresby correspondent, has penned a piece about Papua New Guinea, The Awakening. So I look forward to reading that as well. Thank you, Jonathan. Stay with us. Our first guest in a moment, John Marsden. Jonathan Perlman, editor of Australian Foreign Affairs Journal, is here in the studio with me, and you can pick that up in a bookshop. John Marsden's newest book, I think it's his 714th, is The Art of Growing Up. And he, in fact, pricks the balloon of many of the fads and fashions of modern parenting, in particular indulgent parents who think their children should never experience loss or grief or dirt or the word no, or should never be allowed to cry. There's a whole can of worms we're opening up here. John Marsden, good morning to you.
Good day, John.
You got a death wish.
No, I don't think it's quite that extreme, but there's certainly concerns I've got after being a school principal for 14 years now, and I've had more and more worries over the last 10 years, I suppose, roughly, in terms of the anxiety levels of kids and the panic attacks and the other things that are really concerning about the way young people are growing and the kind of adult futures that they can look forward to.
We can always be tempted to draw the general from the specific, and there's lots of anecdotes. The book is structured with some important points you make, and then you illustrate the point with a whole lot of anecdotes about everything from the things I just mentioned to the insistence by parents that their children are gifted. And that, if I hear one more parent say to me that our children are gifted, I think the top of my head will explode, and you've gone through pretty much the same thing. What is all of that about?
I don't know, but I know that every application we get for PrEP comes with a note from the parent saying that their child is creative, and I suppose that's about the same as gifted. And I'm not quite sure how you assess creativity in a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old, but apparently they've got some formula for working that out. I think it's about the fact that, of course, we want our children to be outstanding, and we have a lot invested in them in an abstract sense as well as a tangible sense. But the reality is that everyone has their strengths and weaknesses. Everyone has their likable behaviours and their unlikable behaviours. Everyone has their good qualities and so-called bad qualities. And the more we can see all people for who they are rather than categorising them, the more progress we're likely to make.
You actually tell us some stories of parents who say to you, oh, look, we thought our child might fit into your school, but after the interview, our 4-year-old, our 5-year-old, our 6-year-old decided that wasn't the school for them. Now,
absolutely,
they might be just saying that in order to be polite, or if they're genuinely letting a 5-year-old make a decision like that, what's gone wrong there?
I think there's an abdication of adult roles in a way. It's almost like, and I think that's, I'll make a general statement about society. I think there's a problem with people becoming adults, that there's an infantilization or an immaturity, perhaps would be a better word, in many adults these days. And so that spills over or impinges on their parenting. So where you have a family where there's a vacuum because the parents aren't taking the role of the adult and being the person who determines the kind of day-to-day routines of the household, for example, then you have a situation where the vacuum will be filled, and it'll be filled by the child who doesn't have a lot of life experience and whose values and attitudes are not yet formed. And so the kind of least appropriate person will take on the role of head of the family, to use a common phrase. And that's the same thing happens in classrooms. If you have a teacher who's not able to manage a class effectively, then the vacuum that that creates won't be filled by that diligent student in the front row who's a role model for everybody else. It'll be filled by the most raucous, poorly behaved, out of control kid who will happily fill the vacuum, but you'll have a very toxic classroom.
And then parents who want to be their kids' friends rather than their parents. What do you do about that?
Well, we talk to them, but we don't get very far sometimes, because people are very sensitive when it comes to parenting, and they will interpret criticism as something that's such a fundamental attack on them that it's incredibly hard to find the words in which to kind of subtly and even gracefully convey to them that they need to perhaps reassess the functioning of the family.
You talk about all this like it's a current modern problem. What do you think's caused it? Why have these parental problems beset us now?
There's a lot of things. I think it's partly that families are much smaller in the number of children that they have for a start. I remember meeting a bloke in Smithton, Tasmania, who had 18 children, and I said, wow, that's a lot of kids. And he said, yeah, the bloke next door had 17, and I was determined to keep going till I beat him, which is a story that I've always been unable to forget. But there's that. There's the fact that the extended family is not so prevalent now, so we're getting more nuclear families. So a very common scenario is the parents, one or two parents with one or two children in a suburban house where they may not even know their neighbours' names, let alone have any contact or interaction with them. And the aunts, uncles, grandparents, whatever, may be living 10 k's away or 1,000 k's away. And so we're getting much more of that. We're getting much more confusion about priorities, I would say, but not everyone would agree with this. We're having a modern house with gleaming stainless steel appliances, with two cars in the garage, both late models, and a trip to Bali or whatever every year is seen as an absolute priority. And so in pursuit of that, people will often end up spending much less time with their children because they're so busy working in order to achieve the material gains that they wish to make.
Do you blame social media for some of this? Do you blame the transformation in communicating? The whole world revolves around quite a different set of human relations in the modern digital era to a generation ago.
Yeah, I think social media is certainly an element, but there's
plenty of... It feeds the narcissism, which is at the core of what you write about.
And it also leads to just kind of snap decisions and quick judgments and sloganising and
short
exchanging of mantras.
Spans.
Yeah, there's not a lot of...
Oh, look, what's out the window there? Did you just see that? Yeah.
There's not a lot of deep thought going on in many areas of our culture. And what I would like is for people to be more reflective and more thoughtful, to try to understand things better rather than rushing to judgment. But it's not just social media, it's all forms of electronic engagement where young people are now not having first-hand experiences. They are instead engaging with computer games and similar, or social media, which is not a meaningful kind of engagement with life. So by playing in a computer game, for example, where you're living in an imaginary world, inhabiting a character created by someone else who is a two-dimensional character, then you're having a very different experience to someone who's down out in the bush building a cubby, or who's skateboarding down a difficult slope, or who's mixing with other stamp collectors as they discuss the stamps of Papua New Guinea. It's these second-hand experiences leading to a life that's lived in a very superficial way and that doesn't help set people up for adult lives.
Sorry, I was just checking my phone. What was that?
Yeah, well, come to think of it, did I turn my phone off before I came in here? I don't think I did.
But it is absolutely chronic at the moment, isn't it? You must support. Surely you're one of those people that supports a ban on phones from, you know, arriving at school until you go home, no phones.
Oh, yeah, we don't have phones at the Candleback. And one of the good things about Candleback is that we can't get mobile phone reception, which is wonderful. And at Alice Miller,
there's a black spot you don't want to
have
solved.
No, I'll be very happy to keep it like that. But Alice Miller, the secondary school, there is people do have phones, but there are quite strong restrictions or limits on what they can use them for or when they can use them.
And they're enforced?
Yeah, we don't go around shouting and confiscating phones, but we say to people, come on, you know you're not allowed to use a phone at this time or in this place.
And if they reoffend and reoffend and reoffend?
Yeah, they generally don't.
Because it's addictive. There's no doubt. It's the same technology we now are learning, the same technology that's used for poker machines to make them trigger the dopamine effect in your brain. It's exactly the same technology being used on mobile phones.
Yeah, and very powerful it is. And it's irresistible for many people. So we do need to be monitoring that and putting limits on it, because that's our job as adults, to put limits and to say no, as well as many other jobs. But those particular jobs are ones that are often neglected nowadays, sadly.
I was interested in you make a big call for the role of of literary fiction in the development of young people. Do you think book sales are down everywhere? It seems like, and partly probably because of phones and other distractions, people are reading less. And it's just interesting, if you look at very young children, they're obsessed with books and stories. So, you know, in your experience as at the school and with young people today, I mean, how much interest do they have in reading, and how does that process occur? When do they drop off? And if they should be reading, how do we hold on to them as readers?
Yeah, reading's holding on better than I had expected or feared would happen. So it's actually staging a bit of a comeback too in many places, especially among teenagers. So I'm not giving up on reading as a way of helping people learn about life, because if you can't have a first-hand experience, you can certainly learn a huge amount. You can acquire wisdom by reading literary fiction, at least, and that's great. And at home, like, we've got six boys, and boys are considered to be less likely to be readers than girls. But of the six, four of them are keen readers. The other two really don't go near a book, I must admit. But of the four, when I said to them, do you prefer electronic books or paper books? A couple of them were like, oh, I'm not fussed either way. But the other two were like, oh, paper, definitely. So it's still holding some place. But it's hard work, and we have to keep working, I think, to make sure it happens, because you will get far more from reading a book than you will from playing a computer game or watching a Hollywood movie, because, again, going back to that two-dimensional, three-dimensional thing, you're in a three-dimensional world when you're reading a book, because the depth of characterization and the exploration of complex plots and themes and ideas is something that computer games can't achieve and may not achieve in our lifetimes.
Hmm. Is I'm interested in your response to Catcher in the Rye. You you talk about the big effect that it had on you.
Yeah,
it changed. Does it hold
my
life. Up as an adult?
Well, I haven't tried reading it for about 20 years, so I'll give it another go. I doubt if it will, because the voice probably will seem a little dated now, but the best books will be readable for many generations. I just reread Mr. Polly last week, actually. Got an audio of it rather than reading it, but I've read it a couple of times before and it still works for me. But that could be a reflection of my age and my Anglo background.
It's a real challenge going back, and sometimes we're disappointed when we revisit.
Yeah, I've certainly had that
something
happen.
From yeah. a long time ago. What happens when you challenge parents about their own bad behaviour within the context of the sorts of lessons? Because you're basically threatening their whole sense of themselves. Everyone thinks they're a pretty good parent. Even if you're not, you still think you are. So what happens?
At some level, they may be fearful that they're not, or they may be aware that they're not. I'd say, loosely speaking, that the parents fall into one of two groups. The first group are not able to hear uncomfortable things suggested about their children, and they react defensively / aggressively. And the other group are able to hear those things and are able to reflect on them and talk about them, and together we can work out strategies which might help the problem situations that arise.
For parents?
Yeah, for the kids. So if a child is having problems with relationships at school, for example, or problems with a teacher or a class, then if the parent is able to think about that and discuss ways of improving the situation, then we'll make great progress. If they're not, then it'll be a struggle. And
when I suppose I was more pointing towards the fact that sometimes your critique is not aimed at the children. It goes bypasses the children and goes straight
yeah,
to
for
the
sure.
parents.
Yeah.
In which case you're kind of in a way undoing their view of themselves.
Yeah, it's dangerous ground, and I've tried to be tactful and careful in the way I put things to people, and I probably sometimes am not as tactful as I'd like to be.
Are you getting some blowback from some of the stories you've told in this book, which are recounting, well, I might say, some episodes of appalling behaviour by parents?
Yeah, the bookshop.
Parents refusing to acknowledge when their kids are violent, when their kids are bullies, and saying, oh, no, it's everyone else's fault, and kids are just mirroring what they've learned at home anyway, and so they can't see, they don't have the insight to see where it's coming from.
Yeah, well, the books aren't hitting the bookshops until the next day or two.
No, so the publicity has well and truly started. You're in the papers on the weekend.
Yeah, it's a bit early to tell, but I'm not expecting to be lavished with praise by parents who object to the approaches I'm taking and the things that I'm saying. But I think we are in a really pretty critical situation with young people, and I haven't said that in my 40 years of teaching and running workshops for kids until the last decade, when it seems to have worsened quite quickly and quite dramatically, and in particular the levels of anxiety where we have young people, and when I say young, they might be 15 or 16, locking themselves in a toilet and ringing their parents because they've lost the textbook, or they've can't find the right classroom, or they've had a friend who said that they are angry at them. And that is something that's quite new in my experience.
Part of the problem, and this is playing to your strengths, John, so you can take this as a bit of a free kick, but the industrial scale on which we educate kids in schools that have got so big, it's even though classrooms might themselves be limited through industrial negotiation with the teachers' union to manageable sizes, but the campuses, I mean, you know, it's not at all unusual to have 1,200, 1,300 kids on a school campus.
Oh, that's considered just a medium-sized school. Yeah, yeah. 3,000 or 4,000 is not
how many?
3,000 or 4,000. There are schools that big in Australia.
I'm not sure that serves teenagers all that well.
No, I'm pretty sure it doesn't. But the idea that we might remodel schools from the ground up seems completely unattainable. It just seems like, as a society, we're not able to tackle those big challenges or come up with those big solutions. Everything's just tinkering around the edges. And so we can't expect profound changes in the way schools function unless we're prepared to completely restructure them. And that willingness is sadly missing from public discussion.
A theme we will continue, I'm sure, with our next guest, Andy Griffiths, children's book author extraordinaire. The Treehouse is now 117 stories, the 117-story Treehouse, illustrated by Terry Denton. But Andy Griffiths joins us on The Conversation Hour next. John Marsden's new book, The Art of Growing Up. It's a weighty tome. Let me see. It's about, I'll find it, 400 pages. And it's full of anecdotes. As I say, it's by no means full of statistics. It's full of anecdotes and stories that have been gleaned by John Marsden's, as he said, 40 years of being in education. And it comes up with all sorts of suggestions and guidelines, including every day, at least once a day, if not more often, you should say no to your child forcefully, formally, and consistently, just so that they get used to the idea that you don't always get what you want in life. It's not bad. And making teenagers work to earn money and not just work around the house, which they should do, but also work outside, all sorts of things that have perhaps just slipped from the present mindset of today's parents. John Marsden, The Art of Growing Up. Jonathan Perlman from Australian Foreign Affairs Journal, my co-host. Text messages. Look, I could read 50 out here, but there was one saying, oh, children these days, dot, dot, dot. The problem with kids these days must be one of the most repeated phrases in human history. I'll acknowledge that, but say it doesn't mean that it's wrong. Now we're joined by Andy Griffiths, author of the 117-story Treehouse, illustrated by Terry Denton. Look, it's getting higher and higher, and the book's getting thicker and thicker. Welcome back, Andy Griffiths. Great to see you in fine
Thank
form.
You very much.
Just goes on. It's like the magic pudding, isn't it? The more you take out, the more there is.
It is exactly like the magic pudding. And we keep finishing each book, and I think that's it. I'm out of ideas. There cannot be any more story, except I've got this one level. I just want to do this one more thing, and then it all starts again. And Terry Denton is just infinite in his ability to illustrate apparently anything. So I'm still trying to find the thing he can't do. That's my challenge.
Between the two of them, you just keep coming up with something that you want to say or a story that you want to tell. Is it some kind of burning desire in you, Andy, that you just have to get it out there? It's not an option.
It's not an option, no. It's probably a calling, I think, in the nicest sense of that word. Yeah, I began as an educator too, observing as a high school teacher, observing all my year seven kids disengaged with reading, preferring movies and computer games, and thinking that books, it was a choice, you know, either books or this, and books are for nerds. And I said, you're making a big mistake. You know, you can have both. A balanced diet can really work for you.
Meat and potatoes.
Yeah. And I started writing little stories for them that
what was the first one? The Day My Bum Went Psycho, was that the first one?
No, the first one was just tricking. It was all about playing practical jokes on people and having those jokes backfire in a really crazy way. And my ethics in those stories was my character can play any joke, no matter how horrible or selfish, as long as he's the one who suffers the most by the end of the story.
Vulnerability is the key.
Yeah, you need to see someone get their comeuppance. And that opened me up that I could do... I have a wide range of things, a great place of freedom that you can go to. And I received a lot of blowback from parents and concerned librarians and teachers in that they said you shouldn't write about someone going outside of the rules of decency and common sense, because then the children will read that and think it's okay and then go and do it themselves. And this was probably the first 20 years of my career as an author was spent fighting this battle, saying kids realise that story and fiction is a game, and we can enter into this game and entertain any idea, no matter how outlandish, no matter how seemingly threatening, and we can process it in this wonderful, safe place that literature gives us, and come out better adjusted people at the end. We don't need to transgress in real life if we've transgressed imaginatively in fiction.
Is anything off limits when you write these books?
The only time we've ever really found the limit is where a character will do something that's clearly horrible and not receive appropriate punishment for it in some form or another. That was in The Bad Book, when Terry and I really started trying to merge our talents and write and draw and have the illustrations tell the story as powerfully as the words. There was about six books where we were experimenting to get the balance right before we hit the treehouse. The Bad Book was the first and most notorious of all of them.
I loved The Bad Book.
We just went in and said, let's just do everything bad. Bad characters, bad stories, bad rhymes. It just gave us a great freedom. And I used those Little Willie rhymes that were very prevalent in Australia in the 40s. Little Willie in his best of sashes fell in the fire and was burned to ashes. By and by, the wind grew chilly, but no one liked to poke poor Willie. And there's a whole rash of these quite dark rhymes. And I thought, oh, we'll write our own. Little Willie took a match and set fire to the cat, said Little Willie as it burnt, I bet the cat hates that. Well, of course the cat hates that. This was understatement in the extreme. But people said, you're trying to encourage people to go out and set fire to cats and you're making fun of it. And I was going, no, you are reading on such a simplistic level. Not even the kids are reading on that level. There was another, the other verse
which implies, I mean, just to unpack that, and John writes about this too, the idea parents have that you have to protect kids from every bad thing.
Exactly.
They shouldn't see the news because something might frighten them or scare them. I mean, life is scary. Life is frightening. The world is hostile and dangerous, and it's better that you talk with kids about it rather than try and pretend you can shield them from everything.
Well, yeah. Values are taught by the parents mostly, and if they're so fragile or so badly taught that the child reads one book and then goes out and does something absolutely appalling, then there's something terribly wrong with the early influences in the child's life.
Well, I reckon your job as a teacher would be much much easier if you could just write a story illustrating some precept of behaviour and the kids just read it and went, OK, we'll be honest now.
Oh, yeah.
We'll never do anything wrong.
I mean, change the world in 24 hours.
Of course.
Fix every problem.
But none of us are like that. And I've always thought good children's literature touches these areas of fear and danger and gives us a language to talk about them and experience them safely in our imagination and then come back and And yeah, if you have a good teacher or parent who can then talk you through and have a conversation, then that's a bonus. But
Norman Lindsay, who wrote The Magic Pudding, said that all kids want to read about is food and fighting, and that's what The Magic Pudding is. And it's a great book because
and farting,
so full of both of them.
To this man.
Well, yes, Andy's added farting to the equation.
No, I didn't add farting to the equation.
Sorry.
And I don't find farts particularly funny. I find the fact that kids find them funny.
Yeah, that's...
That is very amusing
from
to
an
me.
Early age, from about 4 or 5 onwards, they think bums are farting.
Because they're getting used to their bodies. Their bodies are creating these noises and they can't control them. And yet the adults around them are getting angry at them. So there's an area of anxiety here. And
cows fart, dogs fart. I mean, come on.
Where I come in as a humorist is when there's an area of tension... It's ripe for comedy, so you can name those things, have fun with them, and we can all move on and realise that everyone farts. And
can I upend the conversation? How do you both avoid burnout? I've lost track of how many books each of you has written. I'm sure you know off the top of your head, Andy.
I'm an advocate of Ray Bradbury's theory of creativity, which he said, every day I stuff myself full of good music, of books, of films, of things that I love, and then I sit down to write each morning and it all erupts like old faithful.
You've got about, 40 books that you've published?
Around that, yes.
Around that, John?
Yeah, I'm about the same number, and I just... keep coming across situations or people or both which fascinate me, which I can't understand. And so I'll typically write a book because that'll help me get closer to what's really going on and bring me closer to some sort of understanding of the truth, even though the truth as a concept is inaccessible.
But how do you avoid burnout?
I don't know. I mean, we're all storytellers. We all tell stories every day. We'll tell stories about what happened at work or what happened on the train or what happened to the kids at school. And the only difference is that Andy and I and others write stories and merge them or synthesize them into an ongoing narrative where there might be hundreds of stories all within the pages of one book. But that's just one step beyond what people do when they chat each day to their friends, neighbours, workmates and so on.
And it's enormously motivational to have an appreciative audience for a story.
Yeah.
And once you have that audience and they're hungering for more... it's not hard to get out of bed in the morning and what else can I think up? How can I entertain them and involve them and sell the idea of reading as a really, you know, wonderful pastime?
Andy, how do you work with Terry? Because parts of the story just seem very written to the illustration. Do you sit down and plot it together or come up with things along the way? How do you collaborate?
For many years we did, and this was the big journey in the books, really. It used to be me writing the stories and he would come along at the end and decorate the edges of the page. But I loved what he was doing in those edges. And I said, let's get together each week and try to influence each other at the point of conception so that neither of us is writing the story. We're both leading each other. As I said, it took about 6 or 7 books to get that right, to make it a dance rather than someone determining. As these days, we don't have to get together so much. Our heads have kind of merged. And I know what he's capable of. I know what I think he might be capable of, and I push him. But I'll pitch an idea. He'll send me a few drawings back, and those drawings will then trigger me and go... Oh, I could even take that further. And so a narrative will emerge backwards and forwards. He'll sometimes draw the wrong thing. I'll get the drawings back, and that's not what I meant, but it's actually better than what I meant. So then I'll change the text to accommodate his drawings. And sometimes his drawings will be not particularly inspiring, and I'll go, that's because my text is boring, and so I'll cut a whole lot of stuff out.
And he's sort of the protagonist of this book in some ways.
He's the wayward idiot who won't attend to the deadlines because he's, instead of doing what I want him to do, he's drawing a picture of his finger. And Andy is the responsible, you know, one trying to make the deadline. But I can't make the deadline without the diversions. So it's a sort of marrying of structure and chaos.
So that collaboration is specific to these projects. Is there anyone else you've ever had the same connection with? Creative connection?
No, Terry was the first illustrator I was assigned in 1993 when I wrote a creative writing textbook. That was my actual first book. And they just said, oh, we know this guy called Terry. He's got a good sense of humour. I think he'll be good for you. And they were absolutely right. And at that time, I could see he had a window into my imagination. The first cover that he drew was kids swinging on a clothesline, flying off into outer space. They were going so fast. I went, that is the perfect metaphor for play and my process. And he encouraged me to keep going at that point. And I said, he said, you should publish a book of fiction, not just textbooks. And I said, no one will publish my work because all the publishers were, they couldn't understand what I was doing. They just thought it was mad, which it was. They said, well, it's very entertaining, but we can't see an audience for this.
Is it similar to...
I've been self-publishing, and so I knew there was an audience. Mm. But Terry said, I'll tell them I'll illustrate anything. So he helped me get established at that point. He was an award-winning illustrator. I don't think he's ever won an award since getting involved with me.
Gave you credibility, really.
Totally. And then I dragged him down to my level and we've been very happy ever since.
Do you find that process of working with him as the illustrator, how does that compare with your punk background, being a lyricist in a punk band?
It's very, very similar. It is a band, yes. And we, of course, have my wife, Jill, who is an editor, now co-writer, and she oversees. She's a bit of a bridge between us. She's a bridge between us and the audience. So she's like a general reader. Me and Terry can go off down the rabbit hole of pure absurdity and insanity for the sake of it. And Jill will tell us when we've gone too far down that and say, come on, I'm not feeling anything anymore. What happened to the story? What happened to the characters?
Who cares? I really enjoyed the absurdity. I have to say my children are too young at this point to read this and I'm maybe too old for it. So
you're not too old for it.
but coming to read
it,
like
you need it even more.
Well, I love the absurdity and the breaking of conventions, and it just really sort of struck me how you can do this in children's literature in a way that you should be able to do more in adult literature. But when you do it, it seems to just define the genre, you know. So,
oh, but it's the old thing. The Simpsons is wasted on children, for instance. Isn't that well observed?
Well, yeah. The best children's books appeal to people of all ages, yeah. And that's true for Andy's books.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland is kind of the top of the Mount Everest of things that I would aspire to. Peter Pan, which there's a beautiful deconstruction in your book, John. I love the analysis of Peter Pan.
Yeah, there's a lot in that
of what's going on in that story at a deep, you know, mythological subconscious level.
Yeah,
and yet it works on one level as a child story, but it can nurture us as adults. I wouldn't necessarily claim that for my books because I'm more. I think we're more like hit and run comedians. But
so, how did you slip through the education system with your imagination still intact and still working? That's a great achievement.
Well, it never stopped. And Morris Glotzman has always said what makes a children's writer is that you are arrested at a certain phase of development, some of us pre-pubescent, some of us post. But arrested has a negative connotation, but it's just that the window stays open.
And yeah, as that's you a better become way of putting it to you.
As a grown-up, that window to your childhood is still there and it can be accessed and enjoyed and you can play with the what-ifs. It doesn't mean that as an adult you're a total idiot.
Mm.
You can choose, and I think that's where it's nice to have both.
Well, yeah, you one can be values. A total idiot as well.
Totally.
Doesn't mean you are, but you might be.
Yeah, but you've got the choice.
Yeah.
And I think that's good books allow us access to all different parts of ourselves.
And anyway, being a total idiot's kind of professional for you. It's not, you don't do it just because you are an idiot. You do it because that's how you make a living.
You're getting very complicated metafictional territory. It could be because I'm an idiot.
It's very straightforward.
And I'm still that punk rocker who just likes creating chaos.
Well, whatever it is, it works. Andy Griffiths, it's now the 117-story treehouse with the illustrations, the inseparable illustrations of Terry Denton. The 117-story treehouse, which is, I don't know, I've lost count. There's an entire page here of books that Andy and Terry and Andy on his own have done, as there is also for John Marsden, The Art of Growing Up. And the two of them between them have made an extraordinary contribution to our cultural life, for which we all salute you and thank you so much. John Marsden's book, The Art of Growing Up, and Andy Griffiths here for the 117-story treehouse. I don't know how much higher it's going to get. I guess I look forward to learning somewhere down the track. Jonathan Perlman inviting you to have a look at Australian Foreign Affairs Journal, which he's the editor of, and he's been my co-host. Thank you all for coming. This has been The Conversation Hour.